welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 13th of September 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the start of another glorious week in Blighty, and I am here today with my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Or now you have a new name for the website, don't you, Max? You'll have to remind me and listeners what the new name is. But welcome to the show, and how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you very much. The new website is Primal Fellowship, which is www.primal, spelled P-R-I-M-A-L, and fellowship.org. And it's a new website that we're creating in order to replace the Western Spring website as part of, I suppose, a rebranding of our organisation. And I think that it's something that's generally regarded as a sound thing to do from a marketing perspective, to rebrand every so often and regenerate, a bit like Doctor Who, and come back refreshed with a new, perhaps more vigorous approach.
Well, hopefully you won't be turning into a woman anytime soon like Doctor Who did. But there is one woman that's in the news. She's been in the news all over the weekend. It's very hard to actually get away from it. And this is Emma Raducanu. And we're being told that we should be really celebrating this great win because she's won the US Tennis Open, the women's singles, obviously. And it's great that she's won. But I don't really see what that has to do, really, with Britain. She was born in Canada to a Romanian father and a Chinese mother. She moved to Britain with her family, I think when she was 2 years old. So she has British citizenship. But what is it that Britain is supposed to be proud of here? I guess we could say that we gave her good schooling. Are we saying that it was her schooling that enabled her to win the women's singles? I mean, it's a physical thing that she's done there. And you inherit your physique from your parents. And her father was Romanian and her mother was Chinese. So I dare say that it was the Chinese are very disciplined, aren't they? And they work very hard at things. They will spend hours and hours and hours practicing. So I dare say the Chinese side of it was helpful. The Romanian side of it, European, so obviously going to be a larger size than the Chinese. So that probably would have helped physically, but again, that really doesn't have much to do with the British people. And I feel rather sorry for her because, you know, when she looks back, she tries to find somebody who looks like her in her family, and she's not going to be able to. When she looks back and tries to find out the history of her people, to find out the sort of things that she's going to be good at, she's not going to be able to. And who does she identify with? Well, she's told that she should just be identifying with the country that she lives in now. And she could move to another country and gain citizenship in another country. And then that country would be saying, well, hey, look, we've managed to win the Tennis Open. Look at this this great, I don't know, she could say she was German or she could say she was American. And, you know, this is really the way that our history is being taken from us and it's being given to other people, and we're being told that we should be identifying with these other peoples when we already have an identity that is given to us by our ancestors, and we are the sum of our ancestors. So I don't want to take away from her this win, but I just don't see why Britain is all talking about how wonderful this is, and this is a great win for Britain. I guess maybe it is for the British corporation that she is a part of, but not really for the British people, which is a separate entity to the British citizens, I would suggest. Max, are you into the tennis at all? Have you heard about this? You must have heard this mentioned on the news over the weekend.
Yes, I did hear it mentioned on the news. And like you, I think that what Emma Raducanu has achieved is a marvellous thing, and she's to be congratulated, and she would feel very proud of what she's achieved in that respect. So I don't think that we need necessarily feel too sorry for her, just simply by virtue of the fact that she's living in Britain and has been claimed by the British media as being British. The fact of the matter, though, is that in all sporting events, people traditionally would have chosen their local champions who would have gone forward in any sporting contest and who would have represented their town or the village or wherever that they came from. And the local people who would have felt that they were born and bred of the same stock as their local sports people would therefore feel a degree of local patriotism, a local pride that someone among their number has this great prowess that enables them to achieve great things on the sporting field. And as far as Emma Raducanu is concerned, you're quite right that she was born in Canada. She isn't of British stock, and so therefore it whilst we can marvel at the feats of sporting prowess that she's been able to accomplish, we can't feel proud of her in the same way that we would feel proud of somebody who was one of us, who was born of British stock. I think that's fairly plain, basically. But sporting media have entirely taken her to their bosom. And I think that this is largely because she provides somebody that they can hold up as a kind of poster girl for the multicultural society. And the same really goes for the young lady that she defeated at the American Open. I can't think what her name is, but she again was born in Canada. I think that the other young lady and Emma Raducanu were friends. I think they may have even gone to the same school. And this other girl was also of mixed race, and so therefore is in a very similar position to Emma Raducanu. And so it's interesting that both those girls turned out to be such good tennis players. But it's something which I would think would be of just passing interest as far as the British public are concerned. And I think that we should be looking forward to having somebody who is of Indigenous British stock come forward and represent Britain in these kind of sporting contests.
Yeah, you can imagine the Chinese would be very proud of her. I mean, the Chinese have a long tradition of acrobats and training for these sort of things, the same with North Korea. So I can imagine that they would have more pride in Emma Raducanu rather than the British people. I guess. But Max, you were telling me that we have a new Border Force Armada. I mean, it sounds rather like a science fiction team or some kind of children's animation, and I have great doubts that this will actually succeed in being a true defence of our borders. But I did hear Priti Patel was also talking about actually turning around some of these boats that have these illegal immigrants on them that are trying to break into our country. So what's been going on here? What is this new armada? Is it a big fleet of ships? We've got a big fleet of warships. They're going to turn them around. Is that what's going on?
Well, to date, Border Force have tended to rely on five cutters that have been patrolling the English Channel and who have supposedly, as far as the British public are concerned, been supposed to be turning back the people who are trying to illegally immigrate into our country, but who in fact have been picking them up and bringing them ashore so that they can, you know, and acting as kind of like a taxi service for them. And because the Border Force ships aren't tremendously great in number, and this is why the Royal National Lifeboat Association has also become involved in picking up illegal migrants and bringing them ashore as well. And what's been announced recently is that £200 million apparently is going to be spent on a fleet of what are described in the newspapers as high-powered armoured personnel, I don't know whether that's a typing error, watercraft. And this is a very sort of grandiose sounding title for what effectively is a kind of two-man jet ski. And it appears that these jet skis are going to be used in order to turn around the ships that are the boats full of migrants that they encounter, and they're apparently going to stop them from advancing by kind of bumping against the front of the ship while the other because I'm going to be working in pairs, apparently, whilst the other one of these jet skis is going to go around the side and nudge the migrant ship round in order to turn it round through 180 degrees. And then they are going to apparently escort the migrant boats back into French territorial waters. If they venture into French territorial waters without the permission of the French, obviously, that would be an infringement on France's territorial waters, which the French have appeared not to be particularly pleased about and have said that they don't really like that idea at all. And so how far into French territorial waters these migrant boats will be able to be nudged by these border force people on jet skis, I don't know. How many of these jet skis are going to be produced? Again, I don't know, but £28 million, in my view, that would buy an extraordinary large number of jet skis. Unless, of course, the bulk of that £200 million is going to be spent on some more cutters or ships of that kind of size. This scheme has only just been announced when already some fairly senior sounding people like Navy Chief Admiral Lord West has told newspapers over the weekend that this idea by Priti Patel and her staff at Home Office is an accident waiting to happen. And he's added that it's clever and it is problematic. And what he's basically saying there is that as you try to turn these boats around, some of them are likely to sink because a lot of them aren't particularly seaworthy to start off with. And I would imagine that a number of it won't take very long before the people who are transporting the people smugglers concerned and also the people who are being smuggled will learn that if they pop the little sealant tube that holds the air into their boat so that their boat sinks the moment it has contact with these border force people on their jet skis, then the border force people will be forced to rescue them and we'll have to call in a cutter to come and pick up them and then of course carry them back to Britain. So it would appear that the government are going to be spending £200 million, which is going to be completely ineffectual, as virtually every idea that Priti Patel has introduced in terms of stopping mass illegal immigration to this country is concerned. And it will be, as I say, ineffectual, and it will be money down the drain. And it just seems to me that the border force people are inventing more and more kind of recreational ideas so that they can frolic in the sea in their jet skis, having great fun, whilst at the same time failing miserably to actually stop or turn around any of the migrant boats that are going to be coming across.
Yeah, it's like just like window dressing, appearing to do something. I mean, you think about the logistics of it. What are they going to do? Are they going to lasso these dinghies? Are they going to throw a grappling hook onto the dinghies? Of course, grappling hook is going to puncture the dinghy and the dinghy is going to sink and then they're going to have to pick them up. I mean, the solution to this is to make it unattractive for them to try and take the trip in the first place. As I've said so many times, all they have to do is just sort out a safe land that they can take them to, somewhere in Africa, maybe somewhere in Greece, just so that it is a safe zone that will be managed by the British. And then they can just say, if we catch you trying to come into Britain to try and claim asylum, fleeing from war-torn France, we will put you in this safe zone until you want to go back home, which is exactly the same as what Australia did. They put a safe zone up in Papua New Guinea, and there are no more boats that try to break into Australia because they know they're not going to get into Australia. And that complies with the refugee law as well. So why Priti Patel doesn't do it, I don't know. I can hazard a guess that she just wants to make it appear as if she's doing something, because they really don't care, because the more people there are here, the more growth it stimulates, the more benefits they have to create, the more debt has to come out of the banks, the more taxes have to go up. It's just growth all the time. The more houses that have to be built. You were telling me that they'd actually put in a provision in the Queen's bill this year to compensate for a sudden great growth in houses or something, Max, whereas we're not actually reproducing enough to actually replace ourselves. So why do we need any new houses at all? If the Indigenous British replacement rate is 1.7, that means we need less houses each year, not more. And yet we're being told that we need to cut back on planning permission and we need to build millions of houses. I forget what it is. It's something like a city the size of Birmingham every year to house all the new people that are coming here. And they're not the replacements of the British people, because we're not producing enough to replace ourselves. All these new houses, you can say, are being built for the newcomers that our government have invited in. They're basically inviting them in, aren't they? If they're not going to turn them around, if they're saying, well, if you get here, we're not going to turn you around, and when you do get here, you're going to find that the conditions are much, much better than the place that you've come from, that is, in effect, giving them an invitation, isn't it? But tell me about this planning permission thing that was in the Queen's bill, Max.
Well, it was mentioned in the Queen's speech earlier this year, and it's been named the Planning Bill. So presumably it would be the Planning Act 2021 if it ever gets passed. And apparently the bill has now been watered down significantly. Jenrick, I think, is the housing minister. He's apparently decided to water the bill down quite a bit, because it did include this zonal system, as they called it, which made it it did include the zonal system, and it also included mandatory house building targets for councils. And both these two things are apparently now going to be scrapped. It's basically that the Conservatives realised that their loss of Chesham and Amersham earlier on this year in the by-election was largely down to the public perception of this handcuffing and this preventing of people from objecting to masses of new houses being built all around their homes, and so the Conservatives now are, as I say, watering down the policy in order to placate the public. And you're quite right in what you said, that I think there were 244,000 new homes that were reportedly built in the year 2019-2020, which is the highest number of new homes built in Britain since the late 1980s. So that's a considerable period of time. And it's also been reported that there are already 1.1 million new houses with planning permission that are yet to be built. And so if you add the 244, that's perhaps like a yearly amount on top of that 1.1 million, you know, we'll have something like 1.3 million houses that are in the offing, which is a massive number of houses. And as you say, the as far as population growth is concerned, as far as the Indigenous population of Britain is concerned, we are not replacing our numbers. We are a population which is getting slowly smaller at the moment. But the point is that some environmentalists might regard that as being something which is desirable, that we should have a slowly declining population, because it would then create the possibility of us achieving a situation of balance in terms of the resources that are required from the land and the population of people that are that need to live upon those resources. And so for us to be going completely against the environmentalist arguments that would apply in this sphere, and to press on with the building of hundreds of thousands of new homes each year would appear to be completely contradictory to those environmentalist wishes, and one would expect that there should be some absolutely dire, pressing need for new houses before we would produce so many new houses. And of course, there isn't one as far as the British people are concerned, as far as the Indigenous British people are concerned, because we've got enough houses. We've got enough houses for all of our people. The only people we haven't got enough houses for are all of the planned migrants that the government are planning to allow into our country in the years to come. And so what we need to do, if we want to prevent hundreds of thousands of new homes being built all over our country and concreting in vast areas of Britain, then what we need to do is we need to oppose the continuation of mass immigration into this country.
Well, we used to have a green and pleasant land. It's just going to be a grey, concreted overland if they get away with their plans. I mean, it's just lip service that they play to the environment. They talk about care for the environment, but it's just a way to usher in a world government, basically, and world taxes and organisations that transcend national borders. That's what it's all about. They don't really show any concern for preserving the beautiful environment that we have. And you know, it's right that you say there, we do have too many people. White people aren't producing more than we can sustain. It's non-whites that are producing more than they can sustain. And they will continue to do that all the time that we are sustaining them by allowing them into our countries. That's what causes the problem, because if they have too many of them for the resources in a place like Africa, well, the excesses they can just send into Europe, and the Europeans keep accepting them. So if you keep accepting them, that there's nothing there to encourage them not to keep producing more. They have a different strategy, basically. It's called R&K strategy, and one type has less children and invests more time in educating the children and spends longer on bringing them up. And then there's another strategy, which is to have as many children as you possibly can, because some of them might die due to disease and what have you, and you don't spend so much effort on bringing them up, and you don't keep them at home for so long. And it applies throughout the animal world, and it also applies throughout the human world. And then when you mix the two together in multicultural centres, you end up with these problems that we're seeing now, where there aren't enough houses for everyone, and instead of actually cutting back on the population growth rate, the population growth rate keeps increasing. Of course, other problems that will come from this is the waiting lists at the hospitals, the waiting lists at the schools, and also power. Will there be enough? Can we generate enough electricity for all of these people? I hear you had a power cut this week, Max.
Yeah, it's quite unusual, actually. We don't normally have power cuts, but we had a power cut where I live that lasted only around about a minute, but it was a power cut nonetheless. It then just caught my eye that a story that last weekend National Grid needed to turn on one of their coal-fired power stations for the first time in around about 555 days, I think it was. You know, they've been trying to do without coal power for as long as they possibly can, and I seem to remember a while back they announced that they'd managed to go for an entire year without having to switch on a coal-fired power station, but apparently it had to happen about a week ago. And this was because not because it's so cold in Britain that we turned all of our heating on, but because it was so warm in Britain, because we had a high pressure zone nestling over the British Isles at the time, and that high pressure zone brought lots of sunshine, which then caused people to turn their central heating system, their air conditioning systems on, in order to cool their homes down, in order to cool their places of work down. But of course, because it was a high pressure zone, and high pressure zones tend to reduce the wind speeds, not only was there this increase in demand for electricity as a result of the high pressure zone, but also there wasn't the wind to create the electricity needed in order to power the air conditioning systems. And so the National Grid then needed to turn to one of their coal-powered fire stations, power stations rather, and start it up. And this was a power station which is called West Burton A Power Station, which is in Nottinghamshire. And it just occurred to me that because I was having another conversation recently with one of my neighbours about the transition from internal combustion engines to electric cars. By 2030, we're supposed to stop producing internal combustion engines and switch over entirely to electric cars. Well, if we're running electric cars and just turning on the air conditioning can overload our national grid now, then there's going to be a serious problem, I think, that in the years to come, where people switch over to electric cars, and there'll also be then a sort of a switch over from diesel trains to electric trains, and the demand on the national grid is going to just escalate and escalate and escalate. Will we be able to cope with it? will we be able to cope with it in normal times when the wind is blowing? But most of all, will we be able to cope with it if we have hot weather and a high pressure zone nestling over Britain, which causes the winds to drop? And so I can foresee that there are going to be lots of problems of this sort. And I think that where we had that short 1 minute power cut yesterday, it's likely as the years go by that we will start to experience more and more power cuts of longer duration. And this is one of the signs of the degeneration of the infrastructure of a country from first world status down to third world status. Because in third world countries, in countries like within Africa and South America and in Southeast Asia, power cuts are quite a common thing because the countries concerned don't have well-developed grid systems and don't have the power stations needed to produce the amount of power that they require. And this is going to become an increasing thing as we transition from, as I say, from being a first world nation to being a third world nation.
Well, I think we already see this sort of thing happening over in America, don't we? In California, they're always having power cuts. In Texas, when they had that cold snap, they had power cuts. And once again, they had lots of windmills there, but the windmills had all frozen up and they had lots of electric cars there. And everybody with an electric car couldn't heat themselves up. Everybody that still had a petrol car was able to get the car going and they were able to put the heater on. And they were able to stay warm and people ended up dying because of this. And this is happening in America, which is a few years ahead of us over here in Britain. But somewhere that's probably a lot further ahead is South Africa. And you look at the state of the infrastructure there and you look at the power stations there, which are going off all the time and are not being maintained. And you think, well, this is what we are headed for. This is where we are heading to. If our population and our demographics changes so that it ends up looking like the demographics of Africa, our infrastructure is going to look like the same, is going to have the same problems as the infrastructure that we see in South Africa. So we can add that to the problem of transitioning over to things like windmills, is that they don't actually produce enough power. And it's all heading in the wrong direction. It's all heading towards the destruction of our civilization. And of course, you know, we don't want to see that. We want to prevent that from happening. And we want to identify the things that are causing that so that we can prevent that from happening. And we see the same thing happening with all these civilizations in history, which listeners can find out about by listening to our Patriotic History series on Fridays. We look at all the civilizations and what happened to them. And it's the same thing that is happening to our civilization now. They become too big. They bring in people that didn't actually build the civilization. And that causes the collapse of the civilization when they interbreed together and they lose whatever it was that enabled them to create the civilization and maintain it in the first place. But getting back to the power stations here and the cost of everything, I hear the council tax bills are also going up, Max, likely to help pay towards things like Afghan refugees and the 10,000 or so illegal immigrants that have arrived on our shores this year so far, and also all the legal immigrants that arrived here. So what's happening with the council tax bills?
Well, when when the pandemic first began, I can remember writing, predicting that all sorts of problems would emerge from the pandemic. And I predicted that that there would be massive costs involved if we had the lockdowns that followed as a result of the pandemic. And initially, lockdowns weren't muted, but then and there was talk of achieving herd immunity. My recommendation at the time was that we ought to allow those young people who are fit and healthy to continue to keep the economy going and for them not to lock down, and that the resources that the government wanted to make available to protect people's health should be directed at those people who were medically vulnerable to to the virus, and that would have then prevented us from having a situation where we've kept very large numbers of people on furlough, where effectively their incomes have been subsidized by the state, racking up enormous debt, and we've had the eventual admission by governments from government sources that there is now massive debt that's occurred as a result of the lockdowns that we've had, and so we're in a situation now where the chickens have come home to roost, and where we now have to pay for the vast amounts of debt. We've got to pay that debt back, and we've got to create for ourselves the ability to service those much larger debts. And we've seen the first of these a week or so back with the introduction of a social care levy that's going to be added to the national insurance contributions that working people are going to have to pay, but also where people are above state retirement age, where they wouldn't normally pay national insurance, they're still going to have this social care levy levied upon them with regard to whatever part-time earnings or whatever they have. So that's going to discourage some people that that have continued to work even though they are above retirement age from continuing to work, which I don't know that's a good thing. And the fact of the matter, though, is that that 1.25% increase in national insurance or the social care levy, that isn't actually going to be enough to pay back the debts or to service the debts that we've taken on as a nation as a result of lockdown. And what is also going to be needed, it's now being announced, is that there will need to be increases of between 5 to 6% each year in the council tax that people have to pay. And so that's going to further reduce the money that people will have in their pockets. I mean, firstly, the social care levy is going to reduce everybody's income by about 1.5%. So then we're going to have a 5 to 6% increase in council tax, which is going to make a significant difference to the money that people have got to both live on and also to spend. So this is going to have the effect not only of making the general public poorer, but also of impacting upon the shops and the commercial organisations that where ordinary people normally spend their money. And so this is something which is going to be with us for a very long time. It's going to take us generations to pay off the debt that we've incurred as a result of lockdown. Lockdown, in my view, was a completely stupid idea. It was completely unnecessary. We could have simply shielded those people who were vulnerable to COVID-19 and allowed those people who were young and fit and who had very little, were at very little danger from COVID-19 to carry on working, in my view.
So they're basically blaming their lockdown policy for this, but we've also got the immigration policy, which is it ends up costing us more and more money. It's like the more that they do, the more our government do, the less we our prosperity actually increases. You know, you're supposed to progress and things are supposed to get better. They're not supposed to get worse. I dare say the lockdown has cost a lot of money, but so has the government's immigration policy. And it's of course it's the hardworking British population that are the ones that end up paying for all of this while the oligarchs get richer. Well, should we get into our greatest Britain's in Max, or have you got something else you want to add?
Yes, no, let's do that. Let's speak about him.
Yes, I think we've got a really good Greatest Britain to talk about this week. We're going to be talking about Captain Scott. And we've done an earlier series on Ernest Shackleton, the other polar explorer. And he was actually part of Captain Scott's crew on his first expedition. And I've got a really good series of notes for this. But the first part that I've got, actually from the overview that we have here, this actually comes from Wikipedia. Captain Robert Falcon Scott, CVO, born 6th of June 1868, died 29th of March 1912, was a Royal Navy officer and explorer who led two expeditions to the Antarctic regions, the Discovery Expedition of 1901 to 1904 and the ill-fated Terra Nova expedition of 1910 to 1913. On the first expedition, he set a new southern record by marching to latitude 82 degrees south and discovered the Antarctic plateau on which the South Pole is located. So he was the first to discover the area where the South Pole was located. He didn't actually get up to the South Pole. On the second venture, Scott led a party of five which reached the South Pole on the 17th of January 1912, less than 5 weeks after Amundsen's South Pole expedition, and we'll hear about him later on. A planned meeting with supporting dog teams from the base camp had failed, despite Scott's written instructions, and at a distance of 162 miles from their base camp at Hut Point, and approximately 12.5 miles from the next depot, Scott and his companions died. And of course, what they did was they would have people that would go out there beforehand and drop a depot of food and everything that they needed so that they could get to there as they were making their way across. So they knew that they were coming up to somewhere that had supplies, basically, but they just couldn't actually get to that point. When Scott and his party's bodies were discovered, they had in their possessions the first Antarctic fossils ever discovered. The fossils were determined to be from the Glossopteris tree and proved that Antarctica was once forested and joined to the other continents. So it also gave us great advances in science, basically, actually going to this part of the world that nobody had ever been to before. Before his appointment to lead the Discovery expedition, Scott had a career as a naval officer in the Royal Navy. And in 1899, he had a chance encounter with a Sir Clements Markham, who was the president of the Royal Geographical Society, and he thus learned of a planned Antarctic expedition, which he soon volunteered to lead. Having taken this step, his name became inseparably associated with the Antarctic, the field of work to which he remained committed during the final 12 years of his life. Following the news of his death, Scott became a celebrated hero, a status reflected by memorials erected across the UK. However, in the last decades of the 20th century, questions were raised about his competence and character, of course, because we have to criticise all our past heroes in the modern age. Commentators in the 21st century have regarded Scott more positively after assessing the temperature drop below 40 degrees centigrade in March 1912, and after rediscovering Scott's written orders of October 1911, in which he had instructed the dog teams to meet and assist him on the return trip. So there is still information that is coming out about what actually happened here, but he was still the first to actually make it to the South Pole, an amazing feat of endurance, and the tale of what happened to them when they actually froze to death on the second expedition. I mean, that must have been absolutely, absolutely horrific. I mean, this is akin really to being the first men on the moon. It's the first men to actually get somewhere that nobody else has ever been, or like the first men to get to the bottom of the ocean. There isn't much left that we can be the first to do nowadays, but there still was at the turn of the last century. So he was a great hero, and we're going to get into all the details of his life here. But do you want to add anything to that, Max? Any thoughts on what we've said so far?
Well, just firstly, just a correction, because you mentioned that commentators in the 21st century regarded Scott more positively after assessing the temperature drop below, and it's dropped below minus 40 degrees centigrade. You said 40 degrees centigrade, so just really wanted to correct you on that. Other than that, I think it's just well, the other thing as well is another correction, where I my understanding is that Amundsen beat Scott to the South Pole by just a few days. I don't think Scott was the first person to reach there. I think he was beaten by Amundsen.
Yeah, I said he was beaten by Amundsen.
Amundsen. I thought you said that he was the first one to get there. The goal of being the first person to get to the South Pole obviously was there. Yeah, I see what you're saying now. I think it's just, you know, really tragic that he died just 12 and a half miles away from the next depot. I don't know whether he was aware of quite how close he was, or that the sort of dramatic recreations of this always seemed to show him in the middle of a snowstorm. So perhaps he'd become and his men had become disoriented. But it just seems incredible that just 12 and a half miles away, you know, food was there. But I guess 12 and a half miles when you're going through an Arctic landscape is a much greater distance than it would be just wandering over the fields of England.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in some cold weather before. I think about minus 10 with a wind chill factor of minus 30. I mean, if it's minus 40, I mean, that is so cold. I mean, your fingers are going to burn. Your skin is going to burn in that sort of a temperature. And you imagine back then they didn't have the sort of clothing that we have now. They didn't understand nutrition in the way that we did now. I mean, it's amazing that they managed to have enough food to actually keep themselves warm. I think they might have even been poisoned by the tins that they were using, because the technology of tinning food was fairly recent at this time. But again, we'll get to all that when we get to that part in the story. We'll begin with his early life. Robert Falcon Scott was born at Outlands on June the 6th, 1868, to John and Hannah Scott. John had inherited a small brewery in Plymouth, which his father and uncle had bought for £4,782 out of prize money which had been received during the Napoleonic Wars. The family home was also inherited from his father, Robert. This was a house called Outlands near Stoke Dammerall, just outside Devonport. The property, a small country estate, was complete with a nice home, a stream at the bottom of the garden, three large greenhouses, dogs, a peacock on the lawn, and a small staff of maids and gardeners. So it was quite an upper class family, I would say, maybe upper middle class. And this gives us an idea of how much money used to be worth. £4,782 is all that it costs to buy a small brewery. Suffice it to say, this family was a highly respected, very conservative, and rather well-to-do Plymouth family. The sons of such Devon families took to the sea as birds to the air, and one of Hannah's brothers, Harry Cumming, became a vice admiral. Thus, there was a significant naval tradition on both sides of Robert Falcon Scott's parentage. Con, as his parents called him, was born into a large family. He had two older sisters, Etty and Rose, a younger brother Archie, and a younger sister Catherine. So even when you're in the upper classes, they're still taking part in naval activities. They're not just getting involved in banking and those sorts of things back then. Even if you're in the upper class, you were still taking risks and doing physical work. Throughout Con's childhood, daydreaming was a habit he worked hard to overcome, as everyone, including himself, considered it a flaw. Other weaknesses, equally shameful in this era, were his uneasiness with the sight of blood and of suffering in animals. Although he tried hard to conceal it, he never really overcame these perceived problems. And I guess that the suffering in animals thing probably came from butchering animals to eat, because this was a time when we weren't really separated from that. Particularly, I guess, with the lower classes, they would keep pigs and cattle and chickens, and they'd end up slaughtering them themselves and preparing them themselves. I mean, these sort of things still go on in Eastern Europe, and I guess, well, they don't go on the farms anymore in Britain. Everything has to be taken to a slaughterhouse. So I guess that's what he meant by the suffering of animals and uneasiness with the sight of blood. But this was a time when men were men and they were taught to be men. As a boy, he was shy and diffident, small and weakly for his age, lethargic, backwards, and above all, dreamy, as one of his biographers would write. On the other hand, he had a happy childhood, as the first five children were born within a nine-year period, providing plenty of playmates. Although subject to occasional fits of temper, Con's father John was considered an easygoing father with plenty of patience. So he came from a family of seven, I guess that's a reasonable size. I mean, people back then used to have families of a size of 10 or 12. They would always produce more children than the parents, because there was always a chance that these children could die young. Con's mother, Hannah, was loved and worshipped by all the Scots children. To Con, she was always the dear mother. Not much is known about Hannah, but one thing is certain: she had strong religious principles and never questioned the teachings of the Church of England. "My own dearest mother," wrote Con on his departure from New Zealand on his last journey in 1910, "I quite understand and anticipated your anxiety concerning our spiritual welfare. I read the church service every Sunday on our voyage to Melbourne, and I propose to do the same with equal regularity throughout the voyage. You need not have any anxiety on this point." And I think that's probably pretty typical for the people at the time. We were a Christian nation, and that was it. We were a Christian nation. We saw it as being our Christian duty to obey the Christian Bible and to set a good example to others. So that's a summary of what his early life was like. Have you got any comments on that, Max?
Oh, just to reiterate what you said about the Scott coming from a large family, which was customary in those days. It's interesting the amount of money that you mentioned that his family paid for the property that they had. I think the property may even actually be larger, or have been larger, than you perhaps imagine, in that I can remember a few years back now finding an old newspaper in an old house that had properties for sale advertised on the back pages. And I remember an absolutely enormous house with an estate and separate houses for gardeners and gatekeepers and things of this sort for £5,000. So it may be that the Scott family were wealthier than you initially imagined, just seeing that figure there. But religious adherence was something which was taken very seriously in those days. And in those days, the clergymen that used to deliver sermons at church on a Sunday were what were to subsequently become known as fire and brimstone pastors, delivering fire and brimstone services, which were much more intense and which exhorted the congregations to be much more God-fearing and much more hard-working than probably vicars do today.
Definitely more so than vicars do today, where Jesus is just this God of love that forgives everybody and doesn't condemn any particular type of behaviour whatsoever. I mean, they were pretty strict on these things. God-fearing men is what they were. Well, this next bit I find really interesting. Robert F. Scott joined his first seagoing ship in August 1883 at the age of 13. 13 years old. You imagine what 13-year-olds are like now, the first year of your teenage years. And this is an upper-class boy, and that's it. That's his first seagoing ship. The ship HMS Boadicea was the flagship of the Cape Squadron, and in her he served as midshipman for 2 years. So he's got a proper adult male's job at the age of 13 on a ship. This is hard work. This was the first time that young Con had earned money. He was paid about £30 a year. Midshipmen were still students with naval instructors as their teachers, and training was intense for these young men. As Admiral Sir William Jameson wrote, that midshipmen were up aloft in all sorts of weather and away for long hours in boats, under oars and sail. In spite of rigid barriers, young officers learnt the lower deck point of view in a way which is often difficult to achieve in these more democratic days. I mean, this must have been really hard work. The young men worked in the rigging 120 feet above deck. Imagine that. You're climbing up this rope ladder every day, 120 feet, and that's where you're working, is up in this rigging at the age of 13. I mean, the kids today that playing on their computer games, they got no idea of how hard it used to be for us. And we're told that we have this white privilege. Well, this was a privileged young boy. He came from an upper class family, and yet at 13 years old, he's climbing up rigging 120 feet every day in order to do his job. They slept in. Go on.
it's also interesting that at a time when women were supposed to be confined to the kitchen and not allowed to go out and work and were expected just to produce a large family, etc., that his very first ship that he worked on was named after a warrior queen, therefore demonstrating that there wasn't a mindset that women could do nothing other than cook, clean and produce babies in those days, that where there were women of outstanding valour, such as Boadicea, that they were recognised even many centuries after they'd actually lived.
I'll also remind listeners that we have a Greatest Britain's episode on Boadicea, which they will find in the Greatest Britain's archive. Well, the boys slept in hammocks, bathrooms were unknown, instructors were strong and intense in their verbal attacks, and punishment included beatings and extra drill. And I should imagine when they actually got there, they probably had to make up their own cat o' nine tails in order to be whipped with. I know that that's what they used to have to do when they worked on whaling ships. The first thing you would have to do is make up a weapon that was used by the ship's captain to keep discipline against you. And I should imagine they probably did something similar here. They used to keel haul people for bad behaviour as well. They would drag them under the keel of the boat. This is on the whaling ships, of course. I don't know for certain that was on these naval vessels, but it probably a similar thing that was going on. They had to keep strict discipline. And again, remember, this is a 13-year-old boy. As a result, survival created a man from a boy with complete suppression of a young boy's natural feelings of fright, homesickness, and lack of self-confidence. He had to learn to bear pain without flinching, to obey orders directly, and to disregard any immature tendencies. This treatment could be quite traumatic for a young boy coming from a comfortable home. And this is why they would have to be disciplined before then. They would have to have strict discipline. And as Professor Edward Dutton has talked about, particularly with regards to Winston Churchill, these boys from these upper class families, they would be sent to very strict schools where it would be beaten into them that they had to identify with the lower classes. Because otherwise they could end up just having disregard for the other peoples of the country. They had to be taught to sympathise with the working class, and the way to do that would be to give them a sound beating. And then when they came to these important positions within the British Empire, they would empathise with the people that were actually beneath them. So I should imagine he was quite used to beatings before he actually got on the ship. But that was the point of them. It wasn't sadism, wasn't about damaging these people in any way. It was, as it says here, they were trying to create a man from a boy, and they succeeded. I mean, the guy made it all the way to the South Pole. Yeah. Do you want to add anything there, Max?
No, I just agree with what you're saying, yeah.
Conscott was considered an excellent example of a student as he learned the lessons thoroughly while climbing up the lower branches of the Navy. After a brief tour with the HMS Liberty, he served a year on HMS Monarch, whose captain rated Con a promising young officer. And at the end of 1886, he joined HMS Rover and was rated by her captain as an intelligent and capable young officer of temperate habits. So that means that he didn't drink excessively. Don't know whether he was involved in the temperance movement or not, but he was obviously very moral. And you think this is from the age of 13, so he spent all his life on these ships, basically. That was it. That was him leaving home at 13 years of age. When he got to 18, he reached the Royal Navy's training squadron, to which the HMS Rover belonged, and it was cruising in the Caribbean. The midshipmen of the four participating ships raced their cutters across the bay at St. Kitts in the West Indies. The race was narrowly won by Conn, and a few days later, young Conn was invited aboard the HMS Active to dine with the Commodore, Albert Markham. Present at the dinner was Albert's cousin and guest, a middle-aged geographer named Clements Markham. Clements was thoroughly impressed by Conn's intelligence, enthusiasm, and charm, and later wrote, "My final conclusion was that Scott was the destined man to command the Antarctic expedition. Destiny had arrived for young Scott." So he's 18 years old, and he's leading these cutters in this race, and he wins the race. I mean, it must have been a really exciting life, actually.
Yeah,
when
fantastic.
You think about it. just the sort of thing that's missing for young men today. After 9 months on the HMS Rover, Scott went on to spend the winter of 1887 to 88 at the Royal Naval College at Greenwich, and in March 1888 he was awarded first-class certificates in pilotage, torpedoes and gunnery, coming in with the highest marks in his class in his year of seamanship. He was commissioned as a sub-lieutenant, and at the end of 1888 he was instructed to join the cruiser HMS Amphion, stationed near Vancouver, Canada. He had to make his own way across North America, with the last stage of his trip being a long journey in a tramp steamer from San Francisco to Eskimo, BC. And I'll just stop there and say, point out, you know, he's done so well here. He's got the highest marks in his class in that year for seamanship. And this is down to, it has to be down to his parentage, really, and his ancestry, because he comes from a long line of people that were successful from this upper caste. And that was the reason why they were the upper caste, because they were excellent people. He obviously has a very high IQ. He's obviously extremely fit and agile as well. And that all comes from his breeding. That you can't teach somebody at school to be like that. All you can do is work on what is already genetically there, basically. So he was an alpha male, a sort of peak example of the British male, I would describe him as. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
No, I wouldn't disagree with what you said there. I think that's all perfectly true. And it was at a time, these great demands were placed upon young men, great adventures were available for them to participate in at a time when Britain was a much more virile and vigorous nation. And I think those two things go hand in hand. And if we want to have a virile and vigorous nation again, then we've got to invest time in developing our young people and making them as hardy and making them as self-reliant as possible, so that our nation can become hardy and self-reliant.
It's interesting that he hasn't got these visions of himself being a governor in the same way that Enoch Powell did, or some of these others, of working their way up to governorship in the far-flung lands of the British Empire. He's more interested in adventure and going out on these ships and being a captain of his own vessel. After Scott's tour of service in the Pacific, he joined HMS Caroline briefly in the Mediterranean. The summer of 1891 was spent on leave with his family at Outlands. This must have been the first time that he actually had any leave, I should imagine. Otherwise, they wouldn't be making a point of it here. They say this was undoubtedly the most carefree time of Conn's life, as his lieutenant's salary of £182.10 a year provided him with independence, allowing him to pay his own expenses. He played golf with his brothers and played tennis with his sisters, and it was a happy time for the 22-year-old, which is nice to learn, because straight after that, in September 1891, Conn reported to the torpedo training ship HMS Vernon. He graduated with first-class certificates in all subjects and was appointed to HMS Vulcan in the Mediterranean. But by the end of 1894, at the age of 25, Conn received tragic news from his mother. The family was virtually bankrupt. John Scott had sold the brewery on Hoegate Street a few years before and was now enjoying his life of retirement while working in his greenhouses. The financial disaster of 1894 was bad enough, but 3 years later, in October 1897, John Scott died of heart disease at the age of 66, leaving his family without any support or life insurance. This period was extremely difficult for Conn, as he had very little money left to cover his personal expenses after helping his family out, and enjoying a mild weekend of shore leave was out of the question. He had to pinch every penny, as even an occasional glass of wine, a game of golf and so forth were normally too expensive. To take a young woman to dinner would have been impossible. He was cut off from his friends, as he never had the funds to share in the same enjoyments as his comrades. I mean, this is really sad, this, because his father didn't think ahead and get life insurance. I guess he must have thought that he would just continue. And he dies of this heart disease, and suddenly he's no longer able to keep the wages that he has because he's got to pay them back home to keep his mother going and keep the family going, and they've had to sell the house as well. Poverty, and real poverty it was, could only have forced Conn to withdraw unto himself. Years later, he wrote to his future wife, "Do you remember I warned you that secretiveness was strongly developed in me? Don't forget that at 40, the reserve of a lifetime is not easily broken. It has been built up to protect the most sensitive spots." The sensitive spots were his lack of self-confidence, his sense of inferiority, of frustration and isolation, born from his inability to share life's experience with his peers due to his lack of money. But self-pity was not among his faults. There are no complaints in any recorded document written by Conn. So he often recorded what was going on and how he felt. And I guess this must have been very awkward for him. Everybody else going out and you forget that it's not just going out and enjoying yourself. It's also a time where you can communicate with your peers and talk about what's going on and share life experience with them. And he ended up having to miss out on all of that. So he must have been quite a loner by that point, I would have thought. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, I just wonder what the investment was that his father made that evaporated on his father's death, because one would have thought that had the father invested in shares, for example, that those shares would have then been passed on to the mother in his will, and that the income derived from those shares would have continued. But it appears that whatever investments his father made were also dependent upon him surviving, which is strange.
Well, they had the investment in the brewery. And the house came from the Napoleonic Wars, and they sold the brewery. I think he sold the brewery, or had to sell the brewery, which obviously brought in the income. But it says that they were virtually bankrupt. So he sold the brewery a few years before, because he was retiring, expecting that to pay for everything. And it sounds like that only lasted for 3 years. Yeah, and maybe he wasn't particularly financially astute with his investments.
Perhaps the brewery was losing money year by year, and he sold it and then lived off the cash that was left, and eventually it ran out. That's a possibility.
You know, life can be really fickle, can't it? I mean, one minute you can be riding high and you've got everything, and the next minute you've got nothing. You know, you often hear about people that are homeless that at one period in their lives they had a lot of money and they had everything, and suddenly everything goes wrong, and it goes wrong one after the other, all at the worst possible time. And you end up losing everything. But rather than being selfish and saying, well, I've got to live my life, he spent all his money on looking after his family, and he ended up missing out on the things that his peers did. We should probably leave that there, Max, for this week, I think, unless there's anything else you'd like to add. No? Okay.
No, that's fine.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today.
That's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks with another Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.